Some of you may be thinking, haven't we just heard that gospel recently? Probably not most of you, particularly at this time on a Sunday morning, but back on March 12th, we did hear that same gospel. March 12th was the second Sunday of Lent, and typically in Lent, the first Sunday is the temptation of Jesus, and the second is the transfiguration of Jesus. So those two Sundays are kind of the bookends of what will be happening during the season of Lent and Easter, from temptation to transfiguration. So we have heard this, but the reason that we're hearing it today is a little different. I mean, today should be the 18th Sunday in ordinary time, but where it's the Feast of the Transfiguration. What's going on here? In the liturgical calendar, there are a couple of cycles. There is the Sunday cycle that we're all used to of the Easter season, the Christmas season in ordinary time. The other cycle is that of the daily cycle. Days of the year, the numbered days of each month, are assigned feasts or memorials or optional memorials, saints, things like that. And these cycles run somewhat independently of each other, and every so often they collide, like today. While today is a Sunday that would be the 18th Sunday in ordinary time, it is also August 6th. August 6th is the Feast of the Transfiguration. Since it is a Feast of the Lord, it takes precedence over the Sunday. So rather than celebrating the 18th Sunday in ordinary time, we are celebrating the Feast of the Transfiguration of the Lord that occurs every August 6th. So that's why we're hearing those readings, in particular that gospel today. But it gives us a chance to take a look at that gospel that we've already heard in this liturgical year and look at it in a different way. Look at it kind of on its own and rather than as a part of the Lenten season. Okay? So when we look at the Transfiguration kind of with fresh eyes and not embedded in the Lenten season, the first thing I think that you should see is that this description of the vision that Matthew talks about, this vision is embedded in the Judaism of Jesus. You can see that in a couple of ways. First of all, you look at the cast of characters in the Transfiguration story, and in addition to Peter, John, and James, the other two primary characters are Moses and Elijah. Moses and Elijah representing the law and the prophets, or representing Old Testament figures who also had mountaintop experiences. So there's a connection, an immediate connection. Then there's that interesting line where Peter says that he should set up three booths, one for Jesus, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. There are indications in the Gospel of Matthew that this is all happening around the Feast of Tabernacles, that is Sukkot, at which time little booths are built, all right? And these booths are built to remind the people of the 40 years of wandering in the desert. So making tents at this time would make sense. It talks about Exodus. It talks about the Lord taking care of his people in the desert. But it's also a festival of harvest, and it's a festival of hospitality. So just from that simple little line about, shall I make three tents, a whole door opens to the richness of that Jewish festival. But more than anything else, what kind of connects it with the Judaism of Jesus' time is simply the imagery. That imagery of what happens to Jesus, his clothes became as white as light. Sound like the book of Daniel that we heard earlier? His clothing was snow bright. The imagery of the transfiguration in Matthew and Luke and Mark clearly ties it into that vision in the book of Daniel of the Ancient One and the Son of Man. So repeatedly, this story, this vision of the transfiguration, grounds Jesus and his disciples in first century Judaism. But then what more does it do? What about this transfiguration itself? That word can be problematic. When we hear transfiguration, maybe we think transformers of how something changes shape and size or becomes brilliantly colored like it's described here. But if you dig into the Greek root of that word, What it actually has to do with is something like this. It is changing form in keeping with inner reality. Changing form in keeping with inner reality. That which is interior becomes exterior. There isn't a difference between inside and outside. And that, in a sense, is what's happening for the disciples there as the true nature of Jesus is being revealed and is being proclaimed by the voice from heaven that says, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased, listen to him." And again, that harkens back to one of the earlier readings, the second reading, which is interesting because it's another account of the Transfiguration found not in the Gospels, but in the letters. And in this, the second letter of Paul, probably written in the second century by somebody claiming Paul's mantle, talks about, "For he received honor and glory from God the Father when that unique declaration came to him from the majestic glory, 'This is my beloved, my son, my beloved, with whom I am well pleased.'" So transfiguration is a revelation of the true nature of something, letting that true nature take over the whole being of that individual. Transfiguration, majesty, honor, glory. What is the reaction of the disciples to this transfiguration, to this revelation? They are overcome, they fall to the ground, and they are fearful. Okay? The revelation of this great power and honor and majesty strikes fear in their hearts. But in Matthew's gospel, a very interesting thing happens. This is the only one of the three transfiguration accounts in which this line is occurs. "But Jesus came and touched them, saying, 'Rise and do not be afraid. Rise and do not be afraid.'" There they are, afraid of what they have seen and heard. And what Jesus does is something that seemingly goes against that. He comes over, touches them, and says, "Do not be afraid." A very interesting way in which Jesus uses his power and his glory, isn't it? At the beginning, I mentioned calendars. We need to mention another kind of calendar. Believe it or not, it's the calendar of military history. In 1453, the Ottomans captured the city of Constantinople, the last piece of the Byzantine Empire that was left. With the conquest of Constantinople, the Ottomans moved into Europe. And the fall of Europe looked like it could be a real possibility. Where this was stopped was in Belgrade. Belgrade in Serbia. There was a long siege of Belgrade. And finally, in 1456, in late July, that siege was ended and the Ottomans were defeated. So Europe was protected from the Ottoman advance. Pope Calixtus III had been asking the people of Europe to pray for this throughout the siege of the city. And when he received word that the Ottomans had been stopped, this day was established as a day of universal celebration in the church of the Transfiguration. And one has to think also about power and glory of the Lord stopping the Ottoman advance. So from its application to the universal church, this feast day has had its roots in an understanding of power and glory and military might that is not quite the same as what we saw going on in the Transfiguration, where power and glory and honor lead to touching and telling people not to be afraid. The calendar of military history moves forward. On this day, August 6th in 1945, the first atomic weapon was used in the history of warfare on the city of Hiroshima. And then followed up soon later at Nagasaki. The only time in the history, military warfare, that atomic weapons have been used. talk about power and glory? Can you think of anything that is more powerful than the atomic bomb? So here we are on August 6th, on the Feast of the Transfiguration, on the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, which happens every time we celebrate the Feast of the Transfiguration, and we are called to think about what power and glory and majesty means. What is power and glory and majesty? How do we think about it? How do we think about it in our own lives? Do we think about it as military power? Or do we think about it as the Jesus who comes and touches those who are afraid and says, "Do not be afraid"? Because, you know, at the heart of this all, we have a Lord who came to us with tidings not of shock and awe, but tidings of comfort and joy. I believe in one God.